This episode is made possible thanks to listeners like you. Want to support Independent Food Radio? Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today.
I'm Owen Taylor, and I'm the founder of True Love Seeds, which is a seed company that focuses on working with growers to preserve culturally important seeds. And I work with over 20 small-scale farmers, and the question I ask every grower is, what seed tells your story?
Lead me in the kitchen, what are we gonna make? What do you crave? Hold our hearts, our histories, share it on.
I am Nico Whistler, and you are listening to Queer the Table on the Heritage Radio Network. A few months ago, before I actually moved to Philadelphia, I visited and met up with Owen Taylor, whose voice you heard just before the song. We walked to one of my favorite parks in West Philly to talk about his company, True Love Seeds. I sincerely hope that the sound of the ice cream truck rolling by in the background brings you some sweet nostalgic joy.
I'm going to turn your own question on you and ask what seed tells your story.
Okay. Gosh, there's a lot. I do ask every single grower, including myself and my apprentices, this question. And so before I answer the question, I want to say first that I think it's really important for everyone that I work with to answer this question. A lot of times, you know, it's immigrants and people of color who are expected to kind of bring the cultural piece to the table, right? And I've done a lot of work with white people around anti-racism. And we were doing one up at Soulfire Farm in New York for white farmers. And it became clear through our conversations that, you know, we've all lost something in becoming American. That's kind of part of the assimilation story. And while white people have gained whiteness and white privilege, we've also lost our culture. And it's important for us, instead of kind of grasping onto everyone else's cultures, as we tend to do when we think we have no culture because of, you know, this myth of whiteness, why don't we look to see what is ours, you know, what came before us with our ancestors. And so I've been really focusing on Irish and Italian seeds because of my particular ancestry. I grow this squash called Lunga di Napoli, which is really long, as it's called, Lunga. Can be up to maybe 3 feet, 4 feet sometimes long. It's from Naples, also in the title, Lunga di Napoli. And you could really feed a whole village with it. And I love growing it, mostly because it's just amazing to look at, but also because it provides so much food and is really pest and disease resistant. And I grow an Irish potato called the lumper. Of course, potatoes are Andean, but we also know that a big part of their story happened in Ireland. And this was the potato that both saved Irish people, you know. It was like, while the food was being shipped to England, all the good food, there's this myth that there wasn't food in Ireland, and that's why people starve. But it's really has a lot to do with what's still happening today, with rich countries extracting resources from poor countries. And the lumper potato was considered fit for livestock. And so it's something that they get to have and feed themselves with. And a potato is almost a complete nutrition. The problem was that when disease struck and the potatoes were wiped out, then that's when the famine came about. So I grow this potato kind of in remembrance of my great-grandmother, Mary, who was born and raised on a farm in Western Ireland and that grew potatoes, among other things. Yeah. So these are two of the stories. I grew lots of Italian and lots of Irish crops, but these are two of the stories.
Mm-hmm. True Love Seeds is a year old? 2 years old?
Yeah, this is the second year of selling seeds.
Mm-hmm. So. What have been some, like, incredible growth or change moments that have happened in that time?
Yeah, it's still such a young project. I think, again, the greatest thing has been the collaborations. I've never run a business before. I've been in nonprofits, and I intentionally stepped out of that because of the conflicts within myself around grant cycles and orienting ourselves towards funders while saying we're oriented towards the community and shifting priorities based on what money's coming in. That was hard for me to stomach. And I really believed in the food justice work I was doing at Just Food in New York City for so long. I really did. And I think it did a lot of good. But I could never shake the feeling that I was the biggest beneficiary of my work through my paycheck, and my benefits. And so I know that it was good work, but I also felt conflicted about it. I'm like, why am I in this position? This like rural white kid from Connecticut doing work in communities of color and making this paycheck. So I was like, how can I build a different model for what I'm doing where I'm not chasing after things, changing my mission all the time, having funding one year and not the other? How can I instead have a business that either is or isn't supported by people based on the value of the thing that's being produced?
Right.
Not that I'm like wanting to be a capitalist, but I do want to orient towards people. And especially lifting up the stories of the growers and the crops that they find important, it's been pretty awesome to see that people are excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a relief for me
to
see that people want the ají dulce, or the molokhia or the kusa from Palestine or whatever, the lunga de Napoli, that people are like, there's my crop, there's my seed, And so there's a hunger for these crops.
Right.
People are looking for these seeds. So it's been really exciting.
Yeah, I saw that incredible photo that you posted with a chef from Syria and like a reunion with the crop, which is, I can't imagine. I now live in a really small community where it is hard to get plantains, but it's not impossible.
Right.
They come into the grocery store like every 2 months, and I feel like I have a mini version of that moment of like, I can make Puerto Rican food, but for that chef to go 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's those moments are my absolute favorite to like play matchmaker. That's what it feels like. It's like, but it's not like a matchmaker where they hadn't met before. It's the rematriation piece or like just the reunification between people and their tastes of home.
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
Yeah.
That was one of the most powerful moments with the molokhia. But it's been great to see that in many forms, and I hope to do more of that.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to one of the... I've taught at farm school in New York City for maybe a decade. I don't know, a really long time, almost a decade. And one of the students from the first class approached me last week about growing seeds for the catalog. And I'm really excited. And he's going to focus on some Puerto Rican crops, which is his background, and some other Latino and African diasporic crops, which I'm really excited about. So that's what kind of gives me like the will to keep going. Not that I ever feel like I don't have it, but that like really fuels me, those kind of connections.
I want to talk about seed keeping specifically, because I've read I've seen in interviews you make the differentiation between seed saving and seed keeping. And so before we even get into why seed keeping, can you explain that?
Sure. I mean, really, I was introduced to this concept of seed keeping by my friend Blaine Snipstall of Black Dirt Farm Collective, who had been at the White Earth Land Recovery Project's annual Indigenous Farming Conference. And so at this conference in Minnesota, people talk about it as seed keeping. It's a lot of people around the world use this phrase to really connotate not just the saving of genetic material, but the saving of culture, the saving of traditions, the stories that come along with the seeds. I like to say seed keeping to kind of follow in that vein, think about how are we making sure we're not losing the cultural piece along with the seeds. It's so easy for people to just consider them genetic material and almost like the way land grabs are happening, we just do these seed grabs. Somebody cared for that. We've been farming for 10,000 years, right? And so the foods that we're eating were shaped by countless generations of ancestors, and as soon as we lose the name even of the seed, let alone the story, we kind of lose that lineage. And so for me, that's really important to hold on to and to pass down, because we can learn so much about ourselves and our people and other people from holding on to those stories.
Right. And you also do work with growing the seeds, but also giving seeds back to either people that have cultural or ancestral connections to them or regions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been really important to me. My previous work was at a private seed collection, the Roughwood Seed Collection. And it was awesome. I learned so much. I was there for 4 years managing the collection, but it was very much, you know, a living museum, right? And so many peoples from all over the world, including many indigenous peoples, seeds were in this collection. And that's a really important role for someone to play, because from there, you can do this work of rematriation. You know, when some seeds have been lost in the communities that they originally come from, there's this opportunity from a seed bank like that to do this rematriation work, which is a term I've learned from Rowan White, who's a Mohawk seed keeper and a dear friend of mine. This idea, you know, the same thing with important quote-unquote artifacts in museums that are being repatriated from the museums back to their original people, that's the same idea with seeds. And so I think, you know, the reason I focus on people's ancestral seeds, I think I really, the bigger thing for me is not just grow your ancestral seeds, but to like have community sovereignty and seed sovereignty and have control over your food system. And what's the better relationship to form with a seed than the seed that your people were caring for? To me, it seems like the farmers I'm working with are much more committed to this work because they're holding these precious seeds that feel connected to their story.
Okay, time for a quick break. Owen and I will be back in a minute talking about all of the ways that seed keeping and queer chosen family are connected.
This episode is brought to you by you. As an independent, member-supported nonprofit, the amazing content you hear on Heritage Radio Network is made possible thanks to our generous community of members and partners. For 10 years, HRN has been a defining voice in America's food movement, and we never would have made it this far without you. Join us in celebrating an amazing decade of food radio and support our summer fund drive by becoming a member of HRN. You can choose from our member gifts and will receive exclusive discounts on HRN events. We truly believe that with your help, we can change the world and our food system one bite or sound bite at a time. But there's no food radio without you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate before July 31st to do your part to ensure a bright future for your favorite food podcasts.
I have a question that I am not sure how to frame. As you're talking about this, like, connection to ancestry, and there's, like, a through line there that speaks to family for some people. And I don't know if this question has an answer, but I'm thinking about queer family and queer family structures over time. But I am wondering if you see a through line between queer community or queer ancestry and seed saving.
That's interesting. I think more in my own context, and I'll think about the historical context a little more. I mean, I think about this a lot. A friend of mine made a documentary called Out Here, Queer Farmer Film Project, and he's now one of my growers. And we grew up together. He's friends with my sister, Jonah Mossberg. And I remember back then when he was interviewing me and my partner about, like, what does it mean to be a queer farmer? We were like, I don't know. I don't know. We're queer, we're farmers. But it does manifest in the workings of True Love Seeds, in that my community is historically a queer community. And so as I've been working with growers, my friends have been like, can I be one of your growers? And so it's not something I advertise with True Love Seeds. Like, really, I try to focus on who's doing work to further collective liberation and food justice, right? And my emphasis has really been on racial and economic justice. And how can this work with ancestral seeds and seed keeping be towards racial and economic justice in the food system? And so that's the story that I put out there. That's the story I think needs to be told. We see a lot of work happening around seed saving that's not explicitly about justice and sovereignty. And I think that that's really important for us to be focusing on that. How can seed production be in service to community food sovereignty and liberation? That said, especially as a young person, my whole world was queer. I mean, when I was, 19 or 20, I moved to the Bay Area with no plan except for to start a queer collective with my friends. You know, I was like, hey, here we are, Oakland. Or whatever, San Francisco, we're going to start a queer collective. Because queerness was a very exciting idea for me at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, just having learned about it and kind of feeling this like all-encompassingness of it. And in terms of, you know, having first thought of myself as bisexual and then gay. And then, wait a minute, there's a whole world of queer. And it's radical and it's, you know, we all believe in, you know, social change and kind of challenging kind of these normative ideas about what it means to build family and community. That was very exciting to me. And at the same time, I worked with some friends on a farm. And so it just all melded together in this like kind of dream of mine to someday live on some collective farm with my queer family. And so, yeah, these threads kind of braided together and were inseparable. I mean, I don't think farming is inherently queer or whatever. Like, it's just like a human. It's right. Like we've been doing it for 10,000 years. It's what we do. But I think that this kind of idea of doing it collectively or in ways that support the greater good, also not only queer, but definitely lends it, you know, is connected to this queer impulse, mm-hmm. you know, of at least the part of queerness that feels like it's trying to build something together. That doesn't feel succinct and articulate, but that's the answer.
I think that does make a lot of sense. And yeah, I am sure that with deeper digging, there are like land projects that have historical context for it, but it also seems like there might be people creating more of a context for like queer seed saving or mm-hmm. queer ancestral connection through seed now.
I mean, maybe there's threads in there like this kind of impulse that, you know, queer communities have to form family networks and to find kind of self-sufficiency with each other, that kind of has some Venn diagram overlap with, like, back to the landers, you know, mm-hmm. and some of the same impulses, you know, depending on which segment of the queer community you've been talking about. But it does seem like there's this always this dream. It's like it's kind of counter to the American dream of kind of this nuclear family, mm-hmm. but instead like collectively building some alternative where we support each other.
Right.
And have some degree of self-sufficiency. Yeah. And so it does lend itself to like, farming does lend itself to like queer culture and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there's a thread in there around yeah. this. And you know, I do know a lot of seed keepers who are queer and think of it as part of their work around preserving culture. You know, my mentor identifies not as queer, but as a gay man. He's from a different generation. And I see myself kind of continuing his legacy. And it's interesting, my obsession with, like, whole caring history and caring family history as someone who may or may not procreate, you know, within my own immediate family. And I'm like, is this part of how I'm procreating? I'm like replicating, you know, histories and preserving them for the future. And I'm all day, every day, helping plants to procreate and sharing those babies with the world. So anyway, there's lots of areas to explore.
Right.
And that said, I've helped with queer family building. And I do have, you know, friends who I've helped to have a child who I'm very much a part of her life. Mm-hmm. And that feels related to the work that I'm doing with plants as well.
Yeah.
Like finding ways to help these people and plants like kind of make it to the future.
That's a really beautiful connection. I mean, I guess a big question that comes up is, yeah, you are doing so much futurism work just in saving these seeds. But I'm wondering what kind of hopes you have both for True Love Seeds in the immediate future, mm-hmm. maybe, and what you hope kind of the lasting impact of this moment that you're in will be.
Mm. Okay, for the immediate future, I'm just really excited to be working with more farmers who are committed to social justice and healing within their community. And so that's usually where my biggest excitement is especially when it's people that I've known for a really long time and are kind of seeing what we're doing and wanting to incorporate it into their farm projects. And also going deeper with the groups that I'm already working with, people who've been doing it for a year or two in collaboration with True Love Seeds, seeing the possibilities, seeing the challenges in seed production, and wanting to take it deeper. Because really, for me, the goal is building seed sovereignty and building food sovereignty. And so the deeper I can go with the farmers that I'm working with, to the point where producing seeds is second nature, then, goal met. That's, what I'm hoping for. Obviously, we don't all need to be producing seeds for sale, but it's been an interesting project, a tangible project for these groups to kind of have this goal of producing so much high-quality seed and either meeting it or not and doing it differently next year. And so that's been really great, and I just want to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. And you've been training folks who were maybe producing food but not for producing for seed,
right,
on how to do that, right?
Right. There's only one. There's two of the two of the 20-something farms that I'm working with had produced seeds for other catalogs before. I wasn't looking for experienced seed producers, but people whose work kind of was in line with kind of this vision for food justice and food sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a lot of mentorship. It would have been easier in some ways to work with experienced seed producers, but that's not my personal goal in life, to create a smooth running seed company that just all about my, I'm not curating a specific catalog. That's not my goal. It's all about relationships for me, and both between True Love Seeds and the growers and the seeds that they steward. And so that whole process is what it's all about for me, is helping people to become seed stewards.
And we didn't get to big, far-off hopes for the literal seeds that you're planting now, but...
here's my hopes for, the movement, the seed-keeping, the seed sovereignty movement. I mean, my view of it is often in conferences geared towards seed companies. Mm-hmm. And I've been to, over the years, I can't even count how many food conferences I've been to, and I'm tired of it. But I have to go to these seed conferences because I learned so much, and the connections are so important, and I'm still so new to this, so I get so much out of seed conferences. And they're also, the whitest conferences I've ever experienced in my life, by far. And the conferences are already pretty white often, but this is off the charts. And so my long-term hopes is that the seed movement is more reflective of kind of the global seed keepers, as well as the seed keepers in the U.S. who are not necessarily at these conferences. And, people ask me, where can we support, besides buying seeds from True Love Seeds, where a lot of the growers are people of color, where are there seed companies run by people of color? And there's very few. And so, my long-term hopes are to support kind of the building up of the movement to be more representative of the people who are from and who live here.
Right. Yeah, because it's not necessarily that, it's not at all that the majority of seed savers or seed keepers are white.
Absolutely
it's just
not.
That.
It's probably opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority of farmers are and globally, are people of color or women. And in this country, usually seed keepers are immigrants, refugees, people who are still grasping on to, home, right? And the big issue with seeds, people point at Monsanto, people point at the consolidation of the seed industry. These are really big problems. But I think the biggest problem is that we've left the land, right? And we've left a lot of ourselves behind, which usually includes language and religion and dance and seeds. Our food culture is really connected to the land, and we've kind of celebrated our success in this country. We're a rich country. We don't have to grow food anymore. And that means that we've lost so much. We've lost that connection to what makes us who we are. And a lot of times we don't know we're even missing it. And so, when you look at who are the seed keepers, usually it's people who are either indigenous people who are defending their land and their lives and their culture, or immigrants and refugees who have not kind of given that up.
If listeners want to learn more about your work and support your work, where and how can they do that?
Well, social media is a great way to follow what's going on, to hear some seed stories, etc. So I'm at Seedkeeping on Instagram, True Love Seeds on Facebook, Seedkeeping at Tumblr. But also check out the catalog, trueloveseeds.com, especially if you go to the tab that says Meet the Farmers and just take a look. Go visit those farmers' pages, get to hear their stories. I think that's really the best way.
So there you have it. Go check out True Love Seeds. It's still technically July, which means it is not too late to plant some vegetables or some flowers. Queer the Table is produced by me, Nico Whistler. Our logo is by Natalie Uduwella. Denali Gillespie wrote the theme song that you heard at the top of this episode, but today Owen and his band, My Gay Banjo, are going to play us out. This is Limp Wrist and a Steady Hand. We'll link it, as well as the True Love Seeds site and their social media accounts, in the show notes.
You got a limp wrist and a steady hand. I got a strong army to be your man. Lisp when you're excited, and you can't hide it. Got a big old heart, ba-bum, ba-bum, under your chest, ba-bum, ba-bum. Raise your glasses higher, I will buy her. For your mother, above your collar, the city, it turns me mean. Your country has a turnip green, rough around the edges, wild and reckless. Your foot loose, you're a fancy freak on the dance floor at the end of the week. Buy me a tequila, I will heal ya. You're a tall order, you're a tall glass. I wanna roll with you in the tall grass. You're so good, I order. Drink your bath water. Your chest, bump, bump, raise your glasses higher. I will buy her.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.